C1SP. Number 19A.
So, the first subject asks us, invites us, summons us to open thought and admit man's perfection, that man is God's own likeness, to admit it. Then the second subject comes and says, and deny that you have a material selfhood. Deny the material existence. Deny the material world. And through denial, it aids and strengthens us to stay and value the spiritual facts of being. It asks us to take the side of spirit, take definitely the side of spirit, and to deny the beliefs of matter, to deny that any material world, any material selfhood, any material condition can be part of us or of our universe. We just have to deny it. We have to deny that a sickness is any part of us and could ever be any part of us. So, this second subject is built up through three stages and shows first that the denial of material selfhood, that is an aid. It aids the discernment of spiritual selfhood, and that it destroys the knowledge gained from matter. And then, as a second step, it shows that through contrasting spiritual facts with material beliefs, the spiritual facts are better apprehended. That through denying this duality, we are strengthening our understanding of the onlyness of spirit. And through denial, we really are getting more firm in our stand for the spiritual onlyness. And then third, a little paragraph where she shows that belief in absorption, the belief that mind can be absorbed in the brain and can live in the brain and think in the brain, that the divine mind can think in the brain, that leads to sin. And so that sense, that by denying that sense of absorption, we really free ourselves from the belief that we can have sinful thoughts and sinful motives. That's so important, because that alone frees us from a moral sense of good and evil. Then we come to another third subject, soul. And in that third subject, we are asked, so to say, to reject the knowledge of good and evil. And by rejecting the knowledge of good and evil, that spiritualization becomes a present possibility, that now is the day of salvation. See, in the preceding subject, we saw that the claims that there is a nature apart from the nature of God, that life, substance, intelligence is apart from God, that urges to take, to eat from that fruit of knowledge of good and evil, which is next to the tree of life. It urges us to accept that tree of good and evil which is beside the one tree of life. And so in this third subject, the serpent comes in the old scriptural picture we see a serpent coiled around the tree of knowledge and speaking to Adam and Eve, and we get the whispering of the serpent. The whispering of the serpent which wants to say to us that there is a universe apart from God, and that universe is good and evil. and puts forward a lot of whisperings. It says first, shows first that the knowledge of good and evil still portrays man as the outgrowth of human knowledge or sensuality. The claim is still here that, as we so often say, that we say, but at the moment I am not God's image and likeness, but at the moment I can't deny that I am a mortal. That I am a mortal created and born from matter and sensuality and exhibiting a mortal body. So that's the whisper that comes and says, you are both. You are good and evil. You can't deny that. And so we are asked again to reject that whisper and see what she says, that the mortal is not man, is not God's man, but she calls him a burlesque on God's man. He's really a clown, a real clown. We can just look at the mortal and he behaves like a clown, like a burlesque. There is no truth about him. He always plays another part than what really man is. And I think she pointed out that very nicely when she called the mortal a burlesque of God's man. And so we have to see. You see, she really said in the second part that the claim is that mind or spirits can convulse matter. And here she shows that really a belief in man as mortal, in good and evil, makes really a burlesque of him, of man. He acts no more in the dignity of man. How can we tackle that? And we can only tackle that by admitting that man is God's own likeness. Second, by denying that any material selfhood is part of man. And third, by rejecting that this burlesque, that this mortal selfhood has anything to do with our true manhood. We just have to reject that, or we believe that we are a burlesque, a sinner, a fallen man. That's what the serpent has tried to convince us. Then he goes on and says that whispering of the serpent, after the serpent can convince us that man is a mortal, is a creation of a mortal man, that leads to the duality of good and evil and to believe in the reality of good and lastly in the superiority, in the reality of evil and lastly in the superiority of evil. That's always the second claim that comes in. The moment we start with mortality as the basis, as the creative basis, then at the next point we always have the duality of good and evil, and the duality of good and evil usually leads to the belief in the superiority of evil. He says, uncover error and it turns the lie upon you. Until the fact concerning error, namely its nothingness, appears, the moral demand will not be met. She comes in here with that sense which says, it is not enough to hold at the second part which showed the uncovering. Because until we go further to the annihilation of evil, the moral demand will not be met. And if we hold that uncovering, that the error turns the lie upon us, and that's so true. That's something which we see in our life only too much and too often and with too much evil effect. That we that we uncover an error and leave it at that. That's very brutal, because the moment we leave error only uncovered, we make reality out of it. And leaving error only uncovered and not destroyed, we leave it as a reality in our consciousness, and we take it in. It has turned its lie upon us. We have taken it as a reality, and it turns the lie upon us, and it makes us a culprit. So you see, what she says is, what she points out here, let's not stop at uncovering. If we have, I remember Mr. Dole, I don't know if he has written that, but I think he has said that so often, that we should uncover only to annihilate, and that the period of uncovering should be as short as possible and just go on to annihilation and not stay with the uncovering. Because the uncovering only uncovers what the claim of evil claims to be, but it hasn't annihilated it, it hasn't seen its nothingness. And as long as we have not seen the nothingness of a claim, it's still something in our consciousness. And so it turns the lie upon us. And so often people say they like to criticize it. And they defend themselves by criticizing people always and say, but one has to uncover evil. Yes, that's true, but only to destroy it. If we criticize people, that's the best sign that we have only meant or thought we have uncovered something. Usually it's not an uncovering, it's just a human belief. But even if it would be a real criticism, and if we stay there, it's not annihilated and it turns the lie on us, because we believe in that situation. We believe that the person so-and-so has done that and that wrong. Well, that's not annihilation. That's making a reality of evil, and that's making somebody a sinner. That's not moral. That's not spiritual. That's not Christian. So she asks us here to go further and to see the nothingness of what has been uncovered. If we don't do that, then she goes on and says, then we make that real which is not real. We fall into the mistake of believing an evil to be real. We must remember this point, that we must analyze a situation, that we must uncover a situation. But as we saw yesterday, we must uncover it via God, through the divine mind, and not through guessing a mental cause. And the moment we have uncovered it, gone to nothingness, gone to see its nothingness. If we leave it at uncovering, it turns the lie on you, because we begin to believe in the reality of evil. We begin to believe that somebody has done something wrong. That's always false. No, God's man has never done something wrong. That's the whisper of the serpent. The whisper of the serpent is that man can do good and evil, but he can't. God's man is only doing good. So we must go on. The moral demand will not be met until we see the nothingness of evil. Only then we are really Christian. Only then, when we have always traced back an evil to its nothingness, not to a person, not to an act, not to a situation, not to a time, but if we have traces back to really nothing, to a belief that originated in mortal mind, and mortal mind just being a contradiction in itself, we are led back to the unity and oneness of the divine mind as the only substance, the only reality. Then only we have seen the nothingness of evil. So the whisper of the serpent is that it says, yes, you can uncover evil, I don't mind. As long as you believe in evil, it's all right. I have taken you even more into my trap. Then you believe in evil as a reality. You believe in a mistake as real. And if one can, if the serpent can do that, then the third step will be that we believe in the superiority of evil. And the moment we believe in the superiority of evil, we don't believe anymore in the possibility of salvation. But here in the third, she comes and says, "Do you say that the time has not come in which to recognize soul as substantial and able to control the body?" Remember Jesus' word, "Now is the only time, now is the day of salvation. Behold, now is the accepted time," and so on. See, the whisper of the serpent comes and wants to rob us, really, of our freedom and our salvation by first saying, "After all, you are a creation of mortal mind. You are immortal." Accepting that, then we have not annihilated the claim. And accepting that error, we make it real. We say, "Yes, I am a mortal, I know, and as a mortal I am good and I am evil, and I can do good and I can do evil." And the next thing is that we think, that we believe in the superiority of evil, and then we say, "Well, then there is no salvation. Evil is always stronger than I am. Evil is always stronger than all the good intentions which I have, the good motives which I have. It's always the situation, the evil situation, it seems always to be stronger and superior." That's the claim of the serpent. Then it goes on. It builds up and says, as the fourth claim, and says, "And if you believe in that, then you also believe that being is a kingdom divided against itself, that reason and revelation don't coincide, that there is a wonderful revelation which says that God is God's man, but reason and experience and the actual facts don't coincide with it. They are contrary to it, and it's a kingdom against itself. Whereas the true fact of is that divine logic and revelation coincide." And then the whisper of the serpent goes on. The moment it can convince us that there is somewhere perhaps a perfect status and a perfect heaven and earth, but that here and now there is something which does not coincide, not cooperate, or no, you say coincide with that. That if there is we live in a divided kingdom, then the belief is very near, which says, and you know, the destructive mentality, the destructive elements are real. They are. They just lick you. And so we must reject that sense and says, whatever contradicts the divine esse has no reality, has no power. That's how she builds up these whisperings of the serpent, you see. It's all about the arguments that have to be rejected within ourselves, the arguments of the serpent, which always believe in duality, in the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and eating of the tree of good and evil, you shall certainly die. See again the scriptural note which says, but if we have only one God, good spirit, and not many gods, evil, good spirit and evil spirits, but one God, good, we have life. But if we leave that standard and have that belief of good and evil, if we eat of it, you shall surely die. Yeah, I don't want to stay too long on this third subject and just go on to the fourth. You just felt that the third subject was a summoning us to reject the suggestions of evil, the suggestions of the serpent, to have the inward certitude, the inward integrity, the inward consistency to reject all that wants to rob us of our integrity, of our true spiritual selfhood. That we must reject. We have to be constantly on the watch in the third subject, not to let us be robbed of our true inheritance. Then she goes to quite a different proposition of principle, fourth subject. And in that fourth subject, she shows this, that scientific reasoning, starting with God as the divine principle, enables us to arrive at scientific man, demonstrating man and the image and likeness of God. See, we are in the third part considering which scientific tools, which scientific mental tools do we have to use in order to be one with the divine mind. And being one with the divine mind, give birth to our true spiritual selfhood. Which are these tools? The first tools were, first, to open our thought and our vision to admit God, man's perfection as man, as God's own likeness. The second scientific tool was that we deny any material selfhood, a material world, a material situation, that we are not living in a material world, that we are out of that old world, that we are in a new world, a new heaven and a new earth. The third scientific tool was that we are on the watch, that we are not believing the suggestions of the serpent, which says, but that image and likeness of God, God's own image and likeness, is good and evil, and that the experience tells us that he is good and evil, that he is spiritual and material, that man is immortal, that man has to deal with good and evil, that man cannot deny that evil is usually superior to good, that he cannot deny that his whole life experience does not coincide with revelation and divine logic, and that he cannot deny that destructive elements, that there are destructive elements at work. These are the whisperings of the serpent, you see. And how often do these whisperings influence us day in and day out? But naturally, when we are embedded in the security and safety of soul, where we admit God, that man is only and purely God's own likeness, we reject these suggestions. Then we come to the fourth tool. And the fourth tool is really here shown what is the standpoint. What is the standpoint we should take in our consciousness? Or I would say, what is the place which we should take within the divine principle? It is really asking us this. She doesn't say it in her words, but it's really asking this to us. How far do you want to dwell? How far do you want to draw your horizon? How big do you want to have your caliber of your being? How big is your mission, your place in your universe? Is it small? Is it little? Is it finite? Or do you take the inward attitude that you are reflecting the infinite, that you are you taking your position that really you embrace the infinite qualities of being, that you are as big in qualities as God, or are we going to have a narrow, little, small universe? That's the fourth, because the fourth says in principle that principle and idea is one. And in order to express that here, says, all right, then man must see himself as big as God in quality, not in quantity. See, that's so necessary. It's enormous necessary and enormous important. So often, I feel more and more, so often we don't make a demonstration which we should make and which is real, which is necessary and right to make, because we have never the courage to see the bigness of our manhood. Because so often we think, oh, it's quite enough if I have only this and only that and only that little bit, and I want to be very timid and I want to be very bescheiden, modest, thank you, modest and so on, you see. And we feel that to be modest and timid and so on, and just to have one little corner somewhere, that is a divine quality, that is a Christian quality. It isn't. It is limitation. It is making the man who is big, trying to make him small. So the fourth subject, you see, we are in that line where we must see that we find our salvation, our freedom, our bigness. Well, then we must also be big in our consciousness. And that's the fourth subject. The fourth subject asks us to be big in our consciousness. That man must reflect infinite life, truth and love. Man must not reflect a part, a bit, a portion of God. And that's the subject. She begins to show, build it up and says, the infinite can never be in the finite. The infinite cannot be both finite and infinite. That it is an error to believe that the infinite can be in the finite. That we can finitize the infinite. Well, we finitize the infinite if we want to have our being and our life to be only small, then we finitize it. See? And here must come that freedom into our thought and that courage into our thought, that we broaden out our whole consciousness and see that man must take hold of his heritage as the reflection of infinite. She puts that very clear, that infinite, all through that subject, that it is the reflection of infinite life, truth and love. So let's take hold of the bigness of man's being. It shows first that man is really a derivative of God. And that derivative of God is not a portion of God, nor a little quantity of God. That man is not a miniature issue or miniature copy of God, but that he is as big as God qualitatively. That qualitatively he is as big as God. Being as big as God comes to the second point and says, therefore, he reflects the one Spirit. Jesus taught but one God, one Spirit, and that which makes man in the image and likeness of himself. You see, again, you get again that tone that the man is the likeness of God himself, God's own idea. That God makes man as big as he is. And so, he reflects the infinite truth, life and love.